So we've been tracing the exploits of one of the great unsung heroes of the Old Testament, a cupbearer turned governor who also became a pretty handy wall builder, but even more a powerful leader, whose name was Nehemiah. And this is the backstory of his story. In 586 BC, the Babylonians invaded Judah, leveled Jerusalem, including the temple and that great big beautiful city wall. The Jews were scattered throughout Babylon in a captivity that lasted about 140 years. And 50 years later, the geopolitical landscape changed, leaving the Babylonians in defeat and the Persians, who were now in charge. But the king of Persia didn't much care for the Jews being around, so he sent about 50,000 of them back to Jerusalem, where he thought they belonged, to build their former superpower and get it up and running again. The first wave of refugees worked under the leadership of a guy named Zerubbabel, and their task was to rebuild the temple, which isn't a bad place to start if you've got to start over, right? They did it by rebuilding the house of God. And that's when things began looking up for Judah again, and the Jews began to believe that maybe once again they could be the nation of favor they had been under first David and then Solomon. There were just two problems. The people kept sinning, the same sins they had sinned that got them in the problems in the first place. And second, Jerusalem was exposed. Although they did have a temple, what they didn't have was a wall. And back then, a city without a wall wasn't a city at all. Because wild animals could wander in, marauders could invade, pillage and plunder. So in a real sense, Jerusalem, even though they had a temple, the place was still very, very broken. Meanwhile, back in Persia, now known as Iran, Nehemiah was a hostage slash slave serving as a cupbearer to King Artaxerxes. And since he hadn't heard from Jerusalem for quite some time, God decided to send Nehemiah's brother to give him an update, a sad update, that those, quote, who had survived the exile and were back in Jerusalem were in great trouble and disgrace because the wall was broken down and the gates were burned with fire. And when Nehemiah heard that sad news, he wept. Now, that doesn't mean he was weak. He was one tough hombre, but Jerusalem was his nation's treasure, and those living there in trouble and disgrace were his people, so no wonder he wept. Because he wept not only because of the heartache, but God was burdening him with all of this news. And in God's good time, God was going to call him to go back to Jerusalem, rebuild the broken down wall so that Judah could again return to her former glory. So what we've been watching so far in this series is the shaping of God's vision for Nehemiah's life. But remember, it didn't begin as a vision. It began as a burden. And by the way, that's always how a God-driven vision tends to happen. You hear something, see something, maybe you sense something, and it grabs your attention, it breaks your heart. Maybe it's something you read about the direction of our culture, and it sticks in your craw, and you find that you think about it and stress about it and feel burdened about it, even when you're not thinking about anything at all. You lose sleep, you can't eat, you feel blue, because down inside, God is shaping his vision for your life. So we've been documenting that process. And here's the best thing to know whenever God is driving a vision. When it is God who's doing the calling, God will also pave the way so that that calling can get done. And God did. He made a way for the king to let Nehemiah go, to give him all the travel mercies and provisions he would need to make that 800-mile journey safely. And yet, as soon as Nehemiah arrives, whew, talk about discouraged. Because nonstop opposition started rising up from people who didn't want Jerusalem to have a wall, meaning Nehemiah's got to wade through all that garbage. Plus, there was internal opposition by some who claimed to follow God, but they made doing this great work for God also desperately hard. But once Nehemiah finally tamped down all that civil unrest, and after he got a bunch of other distractions resolved, and everybody's on the same page, finally, willing to do the work again, within days, the majority of the heavy lifting related to actually building the wall, man, the wall was almost done. Just set a gate or two, and dude, this project's a wrap. Do you see it? I had rebuilt the wall and not a gap was left, though I hadn't yet set the doors in the gates, meaning there's still a punch list, right? Now, speaking of punch, you got to know punch is precisely what Nehemiah wanted to do to that rascal Sanballat. Remember that dude? He'd been a rock in Nehemiah's sandal from the get-go, and now he's back again. You talk about a snarly, negative, critical guy. Sanballat had all of that in spades. You got anybody like that in your life? Maybe you don't want to raise your hand. And since like attracts like, Sanny had that little buddy Toby. Remember him? He's also back. And me, oh my, there's now a new guy, Geshem the Arab. So this trio of, stooges is now complete. Larry, Moe, and Curly reporting for duty with all their rabble gear sufficiently gathered, including a website, T-shirts, and most important, do you see, Moe has a Twitter account? Because you ain't legit if you ain't on Twitter. So these three hooligans show up. They're shocked to find out that Nehemiah's crew is just days away from finishing their project, meaning all of those threats had no effect. Those critical attacks were made in vain, and so they huddle up again and devise a new tack and decide they're going after the leader, thinking correctly, I think, that if they could get Nehemiah off his game, then maybe the whole project could grind to a halt. And so they send Nehemiah what seems at first to be a rather harmless tweet. Hey, Nehi, what you say we kiss and make up? Light some candles, have dinner at Trump Tower, you know, make nicey nice. Come, you see it? Let's meet together in one of the villages on the plain of Ono. Their plan was to get Nehemiah off the project, separate him from his support network, and then kill him. And even though initially Nehemiah didn't know that was the plan, he responded to their invite to have a summit at Ono with a very decided, oh no, I'm not going to go to Ono. You think I'm a schmo? Because by now, look at this, Nehemiah knew they had intended to do him harm. And so he says, I sent messengers saying, I'm doing a great work, so I can't come down. Why should the work stop while I leave it and come down to you? And they sent to me four times in this same way, and I answered the same way. Now, I want you to note those six powerful words, I am doing a great work. He's not being arrogant or rude. It was true. He was the team leader, and he was being distracted from the work God had called him to do, so, oh no, you don't. I'm doing a great work. I'm not taking time off to go to Ono. I'm sticking to my calling. I'm not coming down. Now, as you absorb those words, I want to tell you something. Something you've probably been wondering ever since we started this series. In fact, I know you have because I've heard the buzz, and I'm here to tell you today the buzz is true. The Crossroads Church, like Judah, is also now engaged in a great work. Now, finally, I get to tell you about it. Been wanting to for a long time. But nearly 2 years ago, knowing our lease agreement was coming up for renewal, we started praying about what God may want us to do next regarding our facilities. Did he want us to sign another long-term lease? That was an option. But the answer seemed to be, time and again, no. We saw much greater value in owning a home as opposed to just leasing one. And a big reason for that is because our leaders feel especially burdened about leaving a legacy of faith for those who in a few years are going to be following in our footsteps. We believe that should Jesus tarry, that this ministry in the future is going to need a permanent home, the same way many of us also have a home that we call our own. But the other reason is we want to be able to control our destiny. And so after months of prayer and research and planning, and after meeting with people both within and outside our church, we developed a bias to own our own digs. We also believed that God was going to send us something for well under market value. After all, we are a young, under-resourced church. So for us to go out and buy a patch of dirt and build a brand new building, man, that was a stretch beyond our ability. And so we asked God if he would give us an already existing building that was in some measure of stress that we could refit for ministry for pennies on the dollar. The faith giants prayed for 50 cents on the dollar. Others prayed for 80 cents on the dollar. But we all began to believe that by faith, God was going to answer that prayer just as he answered Nehemiah's prayer. What we didn't know was where in the world this facility would be. And so what we decided was, if we truly believed God was going to deliver an under-market building, God's delivery of said building would determine its location. Make sense? So we looked all up and down this North Valley corridor, as far south as Happy Valley, several locations here in Anthem, and every possibility in between. And by the way, just to give you another backstory, when we signed leases for this space in 2012, we told our owner at that point and several times since that we would be open to buying this building, partly because we were making a sizable investment here, about $500,000 worth of improvements, in fact. But every time we mentioned it, he wouldn't discuss it with us unless we were so far above market value it made our noses bleed. And we just couldn't make ourselves believe that God could be in a plan that ridiculous. So back to the search we would go. One that yielded serious dialogue with a few different possibilities. We even had a purchase agreement for a BEA-utable building that we were really enamored with and kind of slobbering over because we thought this is the one that God's going to make happen. Just one problem. God wasn't in it. He wasn't. And then our neighbors right over here, the North Valley Christian Academy, broke ground for a new campus and told our owner that they were going to be gone at the end of the school year. And then Dolly Rockers, the hair people, did the same thing. So imagine our surprise when we got a call from the same owner who never wanted to talk to us, even if we were talking 200% of the building's appraised value, now asking us if maybe we were interested in buying this entire South Campus. We politely told him, not for what you want, and thus began a rather protracted and at times convoluted negotiation, one that ended this past Friday with a fully executed purchase contract. And because our funding is already in place, I can safely say our church has secured a permanent home in a building that we've already invested significant kingdom dollars in, dollars that will continue to be used as they were given to be used. And oh, by the way, we also got God's answer to that 60 cents or so on the dollar prayer we had prayed for. Yeah. Yeah. So being the smart men that we are, our elders unanimously voted to purchase these buildings, this entire South Complex. That's a lovely picture. So we've developed both a business plan and a ministry plan that will help us fully leverage this move. The business side of the plan, one that we'll be happy to discuss as time goes along, when fully actualized, we believe it will help us actually accelerate our investments in ministry, investments that up until now we've only been able to dream about and wait for. Investments that will multiply ministry both here in the North Valley as well as around the world. So I want to mention a few items about this move, and then we got to scoot, because to me the great work is not the building, it's what we do with the building. And if you'd like to hear more, some of our elders are going to be available immediately after this service in the conference room just off the cafe. If you can't stay, no worries. After the holidays, we'll be sharing even more details, because details are quickly forming even as I speak. But by buying these two buildings, number one, we're going to be able to triple our space. And we're going to do so for about the same kind of money we currently spend in lease payments for far less space. Plus, we're going to be able to control how it's used. And make no mistake, we got big plans. And though that's the part that really has me stoked, again, going to kind of have to wait till January. But this fully fleshed out plan will enable us to more than double our capacity across every ministry area of our church. Plus, we'll finally have the freedom to do things we've always wanted to do. Can I hear Saturday service, perhaps? Okay. Plus other really cool things. We will also finally put an end to the pitiful lack of visibility we have had to endure, because we're finally going to have a huge expressway side billboard plus a warm, inviting, and wide open front door. Another gift is the partnership with a ministry-based lending group that has an extraordinary track record in ministry, and we believe this relationship is God-ordained, and we hope that you will pray with and perhaps invest in Solomon Foundation. And just so you know, this vision is already receiving the favor of God. Without even having a plan, very quietly last year, we had a building fund seeded with a donation. And throughout the year, it's been growing with other donations. To the point now, without ever saying anything, we have more than enough funds to cover the costs related to completing the transaction, as well as to develop the design and elements that we want to build in our new space. We have also secured 100% of buy-in from our elders, and we are also well on our way to raising the funds we're going to need to do the build-out we believe we need to do to really make this plan work. Just buying a building isn't going to move the needle. We're going to have to do some refitting. And so early next year, we're going to ask everyone in our body, if you would, to join us in making your own move of faith. So stay tuned for that. Enjoy Christmas, and then we'll be back. What I'm saying is, we now know this thing's going to get done. It doesn't mean that the path till now has been easy, because it was anything but that. Neither does it mean that the rest of the journey won't also require faith from us, because it will. But we believe, in fact, your leaders are convinced that God is in this, that this church we both serve and love, a church that began with so very little, a church that did, some of you may not know, we did church in a box for 7.5 years. We operated our offices out of my home for nearly 4 years, and then we did a build-out with the cash we had on hand thanks to the generous volunteer work of people in our body, but a church that has managed to do great ministry and effective outreach in spite of the fact that our front door has been facing our community's backside. This church, filled with bold Nehemiahs, finally gets to sink roots in this community that God called us to reach nearly 12 years ago. Now, as I said, the completed build-out is still going to require generosity from us all. That's why one reason we wanted to go ahead and push the announcement till now and not wait for the big reveal in January, because if there are those in our body for whom there is a tax advantage in making a significant contribution while we're still in 2016, we want to ask you to utilize the Christmas offering as a year-end donation so that you can maximize your tax benefit. We wanted to make sure you had that opportunity. With that said, we got more to say, but we're going to wait until after the holidays. But get ready, because late January, early February, we're going to unveil what will be our fully envisioned plan for what this ministry tool is going to look like and how it's going to be leveraged for the sake of the gospel. And that is what makes this building a great project. It's not the brick and mortar. No, I've been there. I've done that. I've never gone gaga over a building, and I'm even less impressed with church buildings now. And it's because our culture is less impressed with the church, much less a church building. Quite frankly, our culture doesn't like us very much. Have you noticed? Just like they didn't like Jesus. And the protective walls the church once provided, walls that served as the moral guardrails for our nation, those walls, like the walls of Jerusalem, lie in ruins. And as a result, our neighbors, our loved ones, our friends are largely convinced that the church has little, if any, measurable value to them at all. And that's why the American church is graying. According to Dr. George Carey, the church is just one generation away from extinction. So please don't think that us just getting a new building is going to automatically attract the lost to this place like a magnet. It won't. That's our job. But can I tell you why I think this particular building is the right building to help us do that job? During our lengthy search, which had us touring several different buildings, we began to realize with most every choice but this choice that what most every other building would enable us to do was provide yet another single-use repository where already convinced church people could gather to drink in yet another churchy experience along with other churchy activities. Now, I'm not suggesting that such places aren't important. Even Jesus needed places to do ministry. That's why he would hike out to a mountainside or put out in a boat or sit by a well or wait for somebody to talk to or crash a wedding or some other community event. But then he'd surprise everybody by not doing what they suspected that a spiritual leader would do. Because Jesus, in those spontaneous moments, wouldn't preach. He would befriend the broken, the messy, and the wounded. He'd spend time with regular people and not just hang out with the pompous religious hotshots. He'd go to parties, the kind of parties good pastors would never think of going to. Parties with sinners on the guest list, wine on the beverage list, and depravity as the evening's headline entertainment. And as Jesus did what he did in those places, do you remember what began to happen? The very people who wouldn't dream of hanging with somebody like Jesus did exactly that. In fact, Luke tells us about it, and I want to show you. He tells us that one time the tax collectors and sinners were all gathering around to hear Jesus. In other words, Luke is amazed because there was something about Jesus that even bad people wanted to hang with him. Meanwhile, the Pharisees and teachers of the law grumbled. One version says they muttered. Well, of course they did, because that's what pastors do best. We mutter. We grumble. About what? This man receives sinners and even eats with them. Wow. Jesus is intentionally finding ways to make sinners feel welcome, a move that royally honked the religious crowd off. So what does Jesus do? He tells a parable. Some think he told three, but I believe just one with three parts. And everything that follows in Luke 15 is Jesus' response to the religious God squad's disgust for all those sinful groupies that had begun to form around Jesus. I think they were jealous. See, they would go to the synagogues and they would teach and a handful would gather. But none of the people that gathered to hear them also gathered to hear him. Which, on one level, was okay because those sinners didn't fit the profile of a synagogue attendee. What they looked like, acted like, and talked like. Meanwhile, Jesus isn't just drawing a crowd. He's eating with them and having a blast with them. And so the pastors start grumbling. Well, if you're hanging with them, Jesus, you must not be the Messiah you claim to be. Because your church, nothing but outsiders and outlaws. What you've got to say about that, Jesus? Well, what he had to say was a story with three parts. And each part ended with a home filled with people having a party. So, spoiler alert, Jesus is telling us that God's great desire is to bring all his people back home. And that whenever whoever comes home, he wants them to feel so much at home that we're all going to party. Let me tell you about it. Part one, a man with 100 sheep. Except he takes another head count, and there's only 99. I'm not the sharpest crayon in the box, although I am a bright color. But even I know 99 is almost 100. But he can't handle losing even one, so he leaves the 99 and goes looking for the dumb one. And I say dumb because he had wandered off, all right? But instead of the guy cutting his losses, he goes out and he finds the dumb wanderer, puts it on his shoulder, returns to the herd, and then throws a party. Gets on social media, invites his friend list to come to the dumb sheep's blowout. End of part one. Part two is a woman who's also counting. She had 10 coins, but now only 9 because she had clearly misplaced one, most likely in her home, which is why if she had been me, it would have been, girl, just relax. You'll find it when you find it. Now, if it's my phone that's missing, that's another thing. But it's just one coin worth just one day's wage. So again, I probably would have said, just chill. I'm going to pick up an extra shift over at the Dippy Whip and replace that one coin. But no, the language that Jesus uses seems to describe a woman tearing her house up, flipping furniture, shaking rugs, expending far more energy looking for that one coin than she would have expended picking up a shift at the Dippy Whip. Now, eventually she finds it, and unbelievably, she also posts an invite on Facebook so all her peeps can come to the party, one that's going to cost her also way more than the one coin she had worked so hard to find. End of part two. Part three, a dad with two boys. We usually make a big deal about the older and younger, but the point is one was dumb and the other one not quite as dumb. And so the dumb one said, Dad, I need my money. Then he goes to Vegas and lives like a hellion, spends every dime, ends up in a pig slop till it finally dawns on him that Dad's house is a far better house than that house. So he makes his trek back home. Dad sees him and runs to greet him. Now, as a dad, I would have run too, but for a different reason. Because I'm going to let that loser son of mine know what his stupid field trip just cost me. A real told you so kind of moment. But this dad gives his grown-up son, get this, a sloppy welcome home kiss. Then he gives him jewelry, a pair of new Vans, a jacket. And remember that favorite calf of yours, son? He's in the smoker. DJ's out back spinning tunes. We got drink and dancing, all because you came home. And that's Jesus' three-part parable. You pastors want to know why folks don't want to go to your synagogues, but they want to come hear me instead? It's because just like the man and his sheep, the woman and her coin, the dad and his son, I love them. I love like that shepherd. I love like that woman. I love like that dad. What are you trying to say, Jesus? I love illogically.
I love recklessly. I party without limits. Why? Because I want to reach people. That's why. And that's the point of Luke 15. Because Jesus is that man. He is that woman. He is that dad. Meaning Jesus is all about blowing past all logic and reason simply because he's in pursuit of a much higher level of love, a level we call grace. No normal man would leave 99 sheep to find one. What woman would tear up her house for one lousy coin? And though most dads love correcting their kids, Jesus said, I'm throwing a party. What? That's just how I roll. Now, remember why Nehemiah wouldn't take the bait and go over to Ono? It's because he was doing a great work. What was the great work? He was building a wall. And during these long months here, as we've been praying and searching and weeping at times over what does God want us as a church to do, I began to realize, like Nehemiah, God was calling us to a great work too. Except the work that is great isn't about just providing a house. No, the work is great because what God is calling us to do is to make His house their home. But not just a home for the already convinced. The angst of my heart and what I believe God is calling us into is this. Am I more like the religious God squad in Jesus' story? Or am I like Jesus? Because if I truly am following Jesus, which is my calling, which is our mission, then I'm going to look like, love like, and live like Him, right? I don't just show up here to watch another spiritual sideshow. I'm not done just because I can walk away from a parable like this and go, wow, that was great preaching, Jesus. Amen. No, if I really want to be like Jesus, I got to be honest enough to ask, does the construct of my heart and this church look like the values of our founder? I mean, does our church look like the three homes in this parable? No, really, we've got to ask, are we? Do we? You see, if you dissect these three parts, you will find that each part has a four-part progression. The man, the woman, the dad all follow the same four-step plot. Number one, something gets lost. Number two, a search gets launched. Number three, the search continues until what is lost is found. And four, let's have us a party. Same progression all three times. So evidently, that's what Jesus wants His church to be. He wants us to make His house a home. The problem is the church of today has become so much like the religious bigots in Luke 15 who kept throwing the same party for the same people who had been throwing the same party for so long that they forgot why they were throwing the party in the first place. And the point is, I think that's what Sundays are. They're supposed to be parties. Yeah, I went to church today. Didn't feel much like a party. I know. But seriously, doing church is partly the party. Should be. So, where are the lost sheep? Where's the lost coin? The lost son? The kingdom of God is a party, folks, and everybody is invited. The messy, the broken, the losers, the lame. And we all show up here in our various stages of messiness. And it's really, really messy, but at least we're together. Is that not awesome? Unless we're just repeating the same party for the same people over and over and over and over and over and over again until we forget why we're partying in the first place. Does anybody understand what I'm saying?
Every Sunday we see the same people and we do the same thing. Hey. 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 Bud. What up? How are you? Fine. And you? Good. That's good. Well, see you next Sunday. Party on, Wayne. That's not a party. That's not the great work. Isn't the reason we party that we once were lost, but now are found? So ever since we've begun seeking this house that we could make into a new home, what I've been pleading for God for and what I've been praying for is, God, would you help us as we make this house a home, be so committed even as we purchase this house to becoming a community of formerly lost people who can still see the lostness in ourselves, that we are willing to do whatever it takes to launch search teams to seek others who are still lost and then bring them back home again. God, help us remember what it feels like to have been found. And what it feels like to want to party until the cows come home. That's the kind of church I envision us to be. A church that is home to everybody. A church that is willing, because we must. We've got to be willing to create such irresistible, creative environments of such warmth and love that even the unchurched get a kick out of being here. I want us to be a church that intentionally closes the gap caused by the awful cultural mindset that believes, primarily because it's true, that most churches only care about themselves. And most of all, I want us to be a church that silences those who believe, correctly so, that the church exists often just to judge and condemn people who don't look exactly like me. Now, since we have such a unique opportunity to design our house, a house that will shout to our community about the kind of home we long for her to be, your leaders and I are committed to designing, building, and then, as it were, gifting back to our community a space that was designed, funded, and resourced as much for their benefit as for our own, in reckless love, with no strings attached. I'm not just talking about another church building, folks, where church people huddle up and do churchy things. I envision a warm, engaging environment of such magnetic love and a welcoming spirit in this community that even the non-church just kind of dig it when they're here. I also envision this huge interior space between the buildings. I want that to become a playful, family-friendly environment in a totally protected space, closed in, readily available to our community, much like this auditorium is gifted to people in our community for funerals and weddings and other such events. But this space, it's going to be for birthday parties and social gatherings and music nights under the stars and other civic and group activities, gifted to those who can benefit by its use to this end. So that when something tragic happens in their lives, and it will, when someone who came here and felt at home here while they were here, when something about them is broken or winds up missing or feels frightening or new, when whatever it might be causes them to want to seek the hope-filled, eternally proven solutions we know the gospel alone to be, maybe, just maybe, they will see our house as a place they can call home. And that's the work I see. A great work. That you and I would truly look like, love like, and live like Jesus. And make this home that's supposed to be about parties the very kind of home he envisioned it to be. So we must, folks. We absolutely must make it our passion to make this house a home. where lost people are noticed, and where we actively seek to understand and, yes, even accommodate the displaced, the broken, and the lonely. And even if we don't fully understand their story, we try. And they know we try. With this one life you and I have been given, we cannot be content to simply walk in the shadows of Jesus for the 28 years or 38 years or 7 years or 12 years or however long it's been since somebody first threw a party for you. We must not be content to simply allow our reclaimed lives in Christ to keep participating in the same old, stale, recycled party. The same party that's being thrown over and over and over all these years later, still only just for me. I mean, if I was once lost but now found, that's awesome. But if it's been 17 years, and the only party I've taken part in is my party, and I'm still celebrating that party, what that means is, folks, instead of being 17 years old in Christ, I am 1 year old 17 times. You and I need to be like the dad looking out across the horizon, because that's how Jesus was. God said, or Jesus, it was said of Jesus that God made him who knew no sin to be sin for us. That's how aware Jesus was of our lostness. He became what we already were, making him the ultimate example of empathy and compassion. That means he knows your pain, and he knows mine. And he called us together in this house, this weird conglomeration of formerly lost people that we are. And aren't we weird? Thank God we've been found. But then he asks one heart-wrenching question. Will you, the community of followers at the crossroads, will you love me in this city that I love so desperately? Will you love me enough that you'll stop clucking your tongues at lost people? And will you quit disinfecting all your holy spaces, because no lost person is ever going to leave his stink on me? Really? You mean you won't love me enough, Jesus asks, to make your house feel like it's their home? Child, the last thing our world needs is another nice place where nice people get together and learn how to be even more nice. No, we're a hospital. A hospital where spiritually lost people come and find a place they can call home. Church, we got to allow the lostness of this city to so invade our hearts that we recapture what it feels like to be lost. That's compassion, to feel it. So would you join me in that? As we launch in this new adventure, this great new work, would you join me in making this new house such an inviting home for the lost that you and I are willing to go to illogical lengths just to love absolutely anyone? Where you'll search, you'll seek, you'll go and extend yourself just for the sake of another party? Or are we going to be like most churches, where our three operative words are sit, listen, and train? Really, the operative words of a doing church is go seek and find. Let's be willing, even as Jesus was willing, to launch that kind of passionate search to take on more space than we currently need. But it's not because of our own creature comforts. The last thing we need is another church building where people huddle up and do churchy stuff, throwing the same party for the same people year after year after year after year, when what the world really needs is a place of lavish love. And a radical demonstration of what fully accepting love actually looks like. Because we are committed as believers to making our house their home. A home that's welcoming. that meets needs that the lost never dreamed a church would even care about. That's this project, folks. And that's why it's a great work. Because it includes becoming a place where lost people feel loved right into being found. And they also feel like they belong right from the get-go and part of the family. Now, part of the problem and your assignment over the holidays is this. If you have forgotten what it feels like to feel found, if you have forgotten the joy of your salvation, if you have lost the big idea of the gospel, which is you once were lost, but now you're found, then over Christmas, here's what I want you to do. Recapture the vision. Or you will never understand what our founder Jesus wants for this church that he loves. But wouldn't it be awesome to embrace Jesus' great dream for the great house of God, built not for those who are already in, but for those who need to come in. Because Jesus wants everybody to find a home here. And if that's true, maybe they belong here. This is God's house, their home. Not a place where hermetically sealed, over-informed, underutilized, stale party-goers get together, but where party-throwers do scandalous things in the name of looking like, loving like, and living like Jesus. So this Christmas, if you've forgotten, find a way to remember what it's like to be found. Go through some pictures. Ask your mama. Find out who you were before you were found. And make yourself remember that day when you first met Jesus and literally everything about you changed. That's the moment you need to recover. So that when you walk in here and that drum hits that first beat, there's something in your chest that just fights to find its release. Because even if you can't ever hope to find the right words to describe it, you'll remember what it felt like when you finally, after feeling hopelessly displaced and alone for so very long, at last you felt at home again. I plead with you, remember that, so that you can feel with a heart of compassion for those yet to be found. And then ask yourself this: what's it worth to me to extend my life in ways and in measures I've never done before, so that those who don't know what it's like to be found can experience what I'm sitting in right here, right now? Church, what is more important than that? We've got to be the home. We've got to join our Savior in His search for the lost. We've got to embrace the joy of our own foundness. Because almost everybody around us still needs what we once knew. And we got to do whatever needs done by whatever means necessary before it's forever too late. Psalm 68:6 says it best, and we're going to close with this. God settles the solitary in a home. That's powerful. He leads out the prisoners to prosperity, but the rebellious, those not at home, they still dwell in a parched land. But God settles the solitary in a home. And that's what I dream for this church, that we will be a home where God feels it's safe to settle the solitary. That's what I long for. That's what I work for way harder than my wife and my kids and my doctors think I should. But I'm doing it because of the party. I long for a church that's just like home. I don't know. Maybe I've got 10 years, maybe more, by God's grace, to keep doing what God has called me to do. be honest, I've never in all my ministry seen a church like I've just described. I haven't. But this is the one church. I've been a part of growing churches my whole life. Big churches, mega churches, giga churches, gag me churches. But this is the one church that has just the right leadership. She really does. And the right kind of passion. Plus a desire to throw parties for lost people so that we could actually become the church Jesus talked about. It really could happen. So we're going to get a house, and we can do business in this house. So for a while, we'll talk about bricks and mortar, but the home he wants this house to be, that's the point. Let's do it. Let's do it. Are you with me? Oh, Father, I love you. I want that. I've always wanted only that. And I pray, God, that this is that moment. As we prepare for this meal that Jesus died to give us, because he knew all about how to love enough to make someone who was lost found and thrilled to be at home again. As we do that meal, Lord, help us remember. Maybe even in this moment, there will be men and women who will think of that day when they first confessed Jesus. Maybe it was the day when they were baptized and they were put under a little bit of water and came up out of that water in new life. God, restore to us the joy of our salvation that we might make in this place a house that can be a home for those who are lost. In Jesus' name.